Lynn Rossetto Casper with the Splendid Table. Today we have an unconventional take on California winemaking. Randall Graham, creator of Bonnie Doon Vineyard, joins us. He loves the ugly duckling grapes and says, forget the cabs and the Chardonnays, they're not right for California's climate. Randall ends up with award-winning wines with wonderfully weird names like Il Fiasco and the Wine of the Icebox. Jane and Michael Stern are eating Frito Pie in Amarillo. New York Times garden columnist Ann Raver picks the best new culinary seeds. Matthew Goodman celebrates the Passover macaroon. And we're opening the lines for your calls. All this coming up on the Splendid Table. But first, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's talk about asparagus. Talk about a spring vegetable. Nothing says early spring like asparagus. Now, I'm not counting the ones we see all through the winter. Personally, I don't want to eat asparagus at Thanksgiving dinner. Come on, this is a spring vegetable. It's one of the ways we know spring's coming. Besides, buying asparagus in season is cheaper and they taste better. Let's face it, shipping does not improve a vegetable. The shorter the time between when it's on the plant and when it's on your table, the better. Better tasting and better for you. So if you can, buy from local farmers and buy in season. Now, another great thing about eating in season is you get prime flavor. And just when you're getting a little tired of, let's say, asparagus, their season's over and it's time for something new. For those of us who don't have much time to cook and are trying to cut back on calories, you should know that asparagus cook fast, they taste good hot or cold, they're fat-free, and they're low in calories. And you can do a lot with asparagus. Let's start with how to buy them. Then we'll go on to how to cook them, and then finally some ideas for seasoning. Buy organic if you can. Take home only asparagus that are upright and crisp with tightly closed tips. Forget anything that's tired looking. Now, I like pencil slim asparagus. You'll see them mainly at the beginning and the end of the season. They don't need the peeling that the thick ones do. They're elegant, they cook fast, and they cook evenly. Now, let me explain what I mean. With really thick asparagus, by the time the center of the stalk is properly cooked, the outside can be bordering on mushy. Not what I want to eat. With thin asparagus, the surface and the interior are always about the same. One other thing, and this is the most important thing when buying asparagus, is to make sure that they're all the same thickness, so they'll cook evenly. On to cooking. If your asparagus are close to a half inch thick or more, peel them with a vegetable peeler, stroking away from their tips. Break off the tough ends by bending and letting the break happen naturally. There are lots of ways to cook asparagus. You could stand them up in a tall coffee pot with the stems in about 3 inches of boiling water. Now, this way, the thicker stems simmer while the delicate tops just steam. A microwave works, too, and so does a large skillet filled with boiling water. You just spread the asparagus out in it and cook away. Grilled or roasted asparagus are sensational. Just coat them lightly with a little olive oil, a little salt and pepper, and cook. The thin ones are done in about 4 minutes on a grill and in about 10 minutes in a hot oven. Now, what I mean by hot is 450 degrees. No matter how you cook them, the test for doneness is always the same. Pierce the asparagus stem with a knife. If there's a little softening but they're still pretty crisp, stop the cooking immediately. They'll seem underdone, but the residual heat will finish them off. Now for seasoning. Grilled or roasted asparagus take to light mustardy vinaigrettes or some sherry vinegar. Their browned quality is a good foil for the clean, sweet tastes of new potatoes, for instance. You could arrange the asparagus in clusters with slices of steamed potatoes and then dress them with fresh dill and minced red onion and oil and vinegar. Steamed or boiled asparagus are more delicate, and they're wonderful with just salt and fresh lemon. Or you could try a dressing made of olive oil, vinegar, shallot, and lots of fresh tarragon. Shavings of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese on hot or cold asparagus is sheer heaven. Or another great topping for asparagus is anchovies, sautéed in butter with lemon zest and garlic. So try asparagus this week. Just remember not to overcook them, and tune in for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today we talk with rebel winemaker Randall Graham of California's Bonny Doon Vineyard, definitely a man who follows his own drummer. Randall's going to tell us why California's Cabernets and Chardonnays really don't belong there, and why he's created a flock of award-winning wines from what he calls ugly duckling grapes. Personally, I can't resist his wines' names, like Il Fiasco, Old Telegram, and The Wine of the Icebox. Ann Raver writes about gardening and the environment for the New York Times. She's got some great picks of new culinary seeds for planting this year. Matthew Goodman tells us why the macaroon is the ubiquitous Passover food, and he's got a recipe, too. We head for the woods with the wild mushroom man of Santa Cruz. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane Michael, where have you been that's really interesting?
Well, we were in a really strange place, the panhandle of Texas. Have you ever been there, Lynn?
I've driven across it once, but I've never stopped.
It's the world's flattest piece of geography,
literally,
I think.
Literally, it is.
In fact, that's where the alternate runway for the space shuttle is. Isn't that true, Michael? So, in case they can't land at Cape Canaveral, they land in Amarillo?
Yes.
So anyway, it's extremely flat, and it's an extremely interesting city. Michael and I went there to see the Working Ranch Cowboys Association, which are cowboys from working ranches all over the West and Canada who come and compete in teams, to show off their cowboy skills. And after the rodeo, everybody goes to the Golden Light in Amarillo, which is at 2908 West 6th Street, and it is this extremely funky roadhouse with great legendary hamburgers and Frito pie.
What's Frito pie?
Frito pie, one of the great dishes of the Southwest. You find it in Texas and Arkansas primarily. What it is,
and
is
you find it in Texas and Arkansas, but here in Texas, it's called Flagstaff pie, which makes no sense whatsoever since Flagstaff is Arizona. But when you go to the Golden Light, you want to order Flagstaff pie, which is Frito pie.
What it is actually the prototypical super nacho plate, because what they do is lay out a bed of Fritos onto which they put a good stout red chili, cheese, and onions. Traditionally, it was always served inside the Fritos bag, so it was a portable meal. Here at the Golden Light, it's actually served on a plate.
So this is elegant Frito pie?
That's
elegant,
an oxymoron if I ever heard
yeah,
one.
I would
yet.
Not say elegant is an operative word at the Golden Light. it is the Golden Light. Michael and I went there with a friend of ours who is a working cowboy and a truck driver, and he was afraid to go in there with us. We had to assure him he would be safe. It's actually, it's a very nice place when you're inside, but it is a little rough around
well,
the edges.
Some of the decor, for example, is they have some old license plates, beer signs, and my favorite, there was a bumper sticker right above the table where we sat that said, God bless John Wayne.
Now, if you get one of their famous hamburgers, they are one of the few places, especially one of the few funky kind of roadhouse places that I have ever seen, that makes their own hot sauce to go on their hamburgers. You can get it nowhere except at the Golden Light, and it is absolutely terrific. If you're not a regular, you have to ask for it. It only comes to the table if you are somebody they know. But what it is a bottle of smoked jalapenos, garlic, and roasted corn, which has been pureed into a hot sauce. And it is one of the best things to put either on their hand-cut French fries, which are out of this world, or their big old hamburgers.
Sounds good. Very, very good. And Flagstaff pie that's Frito pie that's not in a bag. Hey,
that's an Amarillo.
And I think I just remembered why it's called Flagstaff pie, because Amarillo and Flagstaff are two of the high points along Route 66, which is where this place was. West 6th Street in Amarillo is old Route 66.
So if you eat Flagstaff pie in Amarillo, you will have heartburn all the way to Flagstaff.
No.
Thank you both. Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Now, if you ever plan the motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Or get your kicks on Route 66.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. They're here every week, and every week you can get their road food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. And while you're looking at that road food info, take a look at our online store. We've got autographed books, great vinegars, chocolates, gadgets, stuff that I love to have in my kitchen. And in true public radio style, all the proceeds go to support this very program. Ann Raver writes about gardening and the environment for the New York Times. She's covered everything from the West African roots of dirt gardens in Georgia to revegetating the biggest garbage dump in the world with native plants. Anne, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Anne, I want to know what's really interesting to you right now with new seeds for this coming season.
Okay. Well, there's so much. You'll have to stop me here, but one thing that really stands out in my mind is I was talking with Renee Shepherd out in California, and she has a seed for alpine strawberries, which I've ordered and I'm going to start. And she thinks that this variety is really primo. And the thing about them is you can plant them in a border in the ground, or you can plant them in pots. Or as she does, she has them hanging in pots over, or I guess she uses them in a centerpiece on the table out on the porch or whatever.
You mean so I can have hanging
can just
dinner?
Graze. Yes, you just graze as you're walking by.
I love it. Oh, that's
and
great.
And it's a perennial. So, you know, you plant it once and it'll come back every year. So I love things like that. That's one idea that I think we all should try. And another one is the hardy kiwi. You know, if you have a porch that you want to have some beautiful vines growing up, you can actually grow kiwi fruits now, and they're hardy to zone 6.
Now, do kiwis grow on vines?
They do. It's a beautiful vine. It's a pretty kind of indented leaf, and you have to have a male and a female, which makes it interesting. You know, you have to have a lot of sex in the garden. Though, actually, there's one now called Hayward. I was just seeing in Parks catalog that you don't need 2 vines. But, you know, I sort of like having 2.
I like the idea of sex in the garden. I think that's great.
That's right.
What about greens and stuff like that? Anything out there that's really got
you? Oh, yeah. There's a lot of greens. I have some old faithfuls. I think that when you're really gardening, you know, you have this stable backbone for greens. And I always get a couple of the mesclun mixes, which are sold by almost any good catalog now, mm-hmm. from Cook's to Seeds of Change to Renee Shepherd or Shepherd's or Johnny's, you name it.
Uh-huh.
And I always get tons of arugula. And there's now a nice, wilder version of arugula that has very thin, really indented leaves that's more heat tolerant. And so you have to look for, it's called sativa, S-A-T-I-V-A. And it's arugula, but it's a little tangier and it's really heat tolerant. And arugula, you know, kind of poops out once it gets hot.
Uh-huh.
But I keep growing these greens under shady things. Once the summer really comes, then I kind of start planting seeds under other plants, like, you know, cabbages, or maybe there's a little
shady.
What
a great
plant.
Idea. So you get sort of you protect that and you keep
right.
the greens coming in.
Yeah, huh. you can do a lot that way. And there are lots of wonderful lettuces out there and mustard greens. There's a great lettuce called Freckles. That's kind of a chartreuse with little wine blotches, you know, kind of burgundy blotches.
Uh-huh.
And there's deer tongue, which is real beautiful, narrow, triangular-shaped leaves. And so I just have fun. I mean, I just encourage people to go hog wild in their catalogs and just, you know, or go to the hardware store, your closest botanical garden. They all have these terrific seeds now, right there.
Are you seeing any new trends?
Well, I think there are two things that I am really excited about. One is people with shrinking space, you know, in cities, or maybe they have a little backyard or community gardens. They're going to vertical. I mean, they're trellising everything under the sun, whether it's tomatoes or squash vines or cucumbers, anything that vines, you can grow up. And that means that you have more space down below. You can use a trellis in a big pot, like a whiskey barrel,
mm-hmm.
or you can have a big, long fence in a country garden and just extend it and grow everything that way. And then you have room for, you know, your lettuces and your spinach, and, you know, if you have room for corn. Or so, in other words, trellis what you can, and also add a lot of flowering things that are edible, like pole beans. Or the bean varieties have just exploded. The purple hyacinth bean, which I first saw a man from India growing, there they have this gorgeous purpley green leaf with purple veins.
Ooh.
And then a vermilion pod that is just gorgeous, and this kind of lavender flower. So first you have this flower and you grow it up a trellis, then it has this bean that is absolutely gorgeous, and the pods are good sautéed in a kind of, you know, Indian dish or a spicy dish. And then the beans themselves are very good. And almost any bean has this beautiful sequence.
Hey, Anne, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. It's really fun to talk about my obsession.
Anne Raver's gardening column appears in the New York Times. Coming up, rebel winemaker and Roan Ranger Randall Graham, a historical take on Passover macaroons, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show devoted to life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Randall Graham of Bonnie Doon Vineyard is the original Roan Ranger, the leader of a band of young California vintners who are making wine with grapes from France's Rhone River Valley instead of the more usual Cabernet or Chardonnay. Wine lovers are taking Bonnie Doon wines pretty seriously. Randall, on the other hand, says his mission statement is having as much fun with wine as the relevant government agencies will allow. Randall, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Randall, how did you become a winemaker?
Well, I sometimes say irreverently that it was kind of an interesting way of meeting women, but I'm sure there's more to it than that. Basically, kind of got captured by the whole aesthetic of wine, kind of inadvertently. I wandered into a wine shop about 20 years ago and never seemed to have wandered out.
So you weren't born into a family of great wine drinkers or winemakers?
Hardly. One of the things, my modus operandum is to go back to school. You know, when in doubt, go back to school. So I went back to UC Davis and studied enology and viticulture for a few years. Having gone to school at UC Santa Cruz as a philosophy student.
Interesting combination.
Yes, it stood me in very good stead.
And it explains some of the names of the wines.
I'm not sure what explains the names of these wines. People often ask me, where did these names come from? And I will just tell them drugs. But maybe it's just a call for help. I don't know.
I want to just fill everybody in on this. You have a wine called Il Fiasco. You have a wine called Vin de Glacière, which you say translates as wine of the icebox.
Yes.
And then you've got a red wine, and I should explain, there's a famous red wine in the Rhone River Valley in France that's called, if you translate it, Old Telegraph, and you have a wine that's called in English Old Telegram. Now, where did this come from? What's the goal with this?
Well, the goal is we work with what I call ugly duckling grape varieties, and these are sort of the non-Cabernets and the non-Merlots of the world. And so we have to kind of go the extra mile to make ourselves a little more accessible to people. So we use humor in the labels to reach out and make them feel a little more comfortable about trying the wine.
Does this cause any problems with wine people taking you seriously?
Well, I think wine snobs are a little threatened by my irreverent attitude. But I think we're getting through to the people who really love wine and care about wine. People who really are not so impressed by the label and are more interested in what's inside.
People call you a Rhone Ranger. What does that mean?
Rhone Ranger is kind of a cutesy name, but it has to do with the fact that I'm enamored with the grapes of the Rhone. The various wines that we make are homage to the lovely Châteauneuf-du-Pape and Côte Rôtie and Hermitage that I love so much from the Rhone. It's kind of become a little bit of a craze lately, especially Syrah. Syrah is a grape that's really catching on. People don't understand Syrah, of course, but it is catching on really, really nicely.
Well, what should we know about Syrah?
Syrah is a wonderful grape. It's made in a lot of different styles, from the very bold Australian statement, kind of like bold Australians, to a very elegant, refined French Syrah from the Northern Rhone, like a Côte Rôtie or an Hermitage. I personally favor the elegant style of Syrah, the very peppery, anise, licorice-y Syrah that's really, really elegant. It's kind of a twin sister to Pinot Noir, if you will.
Ah, but you don't produce Pinot Noir, do you?
Well, Pinot Noir has broken my heart so many times that I finally gave up. I love Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir was my mantra when I started as a winemaker, but ultimately it broke my heart too many times. It's just such a difficult grape to grow consistently in California. One year it's great, and you think, my God, I've discovered the secret of life, and the next year it's absolutely ordinary.
Huh. Well, there's another thing. I look at this list of what you produce, and you don't produce the wines I always associate with California, the Merlots, the Cabernet Sauvignons, the Chardonnays.
I have a theory about why people make Cabernet and Chardonnay and Merlot. It has to do with the fact that these are famous grapes, and these are the standards. And ultimately, we are winemakers have suffer often from testosterone toxicity. And this is the standard. How do you know how you rate? If you make a Cabernet or a Merlot, you know how you rate. If you could make the world's best Schioppettino, and who would know and who would care? The idea is that California is a lot more Mediterranean than it is continental, and therefore the Mediterranean grapes are the ones that really will succeed best here. The analogy I sometimes make is you can divide the whole universe into two categories, continental and Mediterranean. You know, continental is butter, Mediterranean is olive oil. Continental is Cary Grant, Mediterranean is Anthony Quinn. Of course, we all want to be Cary Grant. Nobody wants to be Anthony Quinn. But if you are Anthony Quinn, the best thing you can do is be Anthony Quinn. And that's what we are in California. We're Mediterranean. The climate is warm. It's dry. It makes wines with a lot of personality, a lot of emotion, a lot of fruit, a lot of alcohol. When you try to make really refined wines in California, they don't come out refined. They don't want to be refined. They want to have just a lot of presence, a lot of power. And rather than fight City Hall, we should go with our strength rather than fight it.
So where is Bonny Doon geographically, your vineyard, Bonny Doon?
Our vineyard was in a place called Bonny Doon up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, just a little north of the city of Santa Cruz. Unfortunately, our original vineyard perished of a blight called Pierce's disease about 5 years ago.
Huh.
So we now purchase most of our grapes and have a vineyard down in the Salinas Valley in Soledad, right by the California Men's Correctional Facility.
The state prison?
Near the Big House, yes.
Okay.
Which has given rise to one of our labels, which we call Big House Red.
Well, what would you like our listeners to taste of your wines?
Well, they must try the Pacific Rim Riesling, I would say. Most people are really misunderstand and underappreciate Riesling. They have phobias about sweet wines, thinking if they like a sweet wine, it's going to somehow compromise their masculinity or who knows what. but Rieslings are wonderful. They're great food wines. They just work brilliantly with Asian food, with fusion food, far better than those real oaky, fat, buttery Chardonnays that everyone's so happy to drink.
Anything else you'd have us taste?
Well, you also need to try Le Cigar Volant, which is our homage to Châteauneuf-du-Pape. This is our Grenache, Syrah, and Mourvèdre-based wine, which is really, really lovely.
So this is the Flying Cigar.
Flying Cigar, yes.
Right. We will try both. And Randall, thank you.
My pleasure.
Randall Graham is founder of Bonny Doon Vineyard in Santa Cruz, California. You can get information on Randall's wines on our website at splendidtable.org. Matthew Goodman writes about Jewish culinary traditions for The Forward. He always seems to take us down surprising roads. Montreal for bagels, Bukharin restaurants, places you wouldn't think to look for authentic Jewish foods. Hey, Matthew, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Matthew, Passover is upon us, and I want to know why Jewish people always eat macaroons at Passover.
Well, it's one of the great pleasures of Passover time. Jews are not supposed to eat leavened products during Passover. And so macaroons are great because they don't involve any flour at all. They're made simply of ground almonds mixed with sugar and beaten egg whites. Here in the United States, you've probably seen this. They're most often flavored with coconut. Mm-hmm. But in the Middle East and in North Africa, they often have more subtle, even ethereal flavorings. They're often flavored with lemon rind and cardamom, orange blossom water, rose water, and so forth. If you want, you can dip them into melted chocolate, which is quite delicious, of course. It may be gilding the lily just a bit. But you know what's interesting is that macaroons are made by Jewish chefs all around the world, but their origins are decidedly non-Jewish.
What do you mean?
Well, the earliest account of macaroons traces them back to a French monastery in the 8th century, where they were purportedly made in the shape of monks' navels. Now, whether or not monks' navels were shaped differently than anybody else's is left out of the historical record, but there you are.
So, Matthew, from the monastery to now, I mean, have macaroons gone the way of the bagel? You know, now we have blueberry bagels and we've got, you know.
Do you mean do we have sun-dried tomato macaroons or
pesto macaroons? Yeah, exactly.
Not quite. But, you know, I was on the Manischewitz website the other day. And, you know, Manischewitz is about the most traditional company that there is. It's been around for 100 years making, you know, matzahs and that sweet kosher wine, which is so thick you want to eat it with a fork, and macaroons.
Uh-huh.
And traditionally, you know, it's been the coconut macaroons, the almond macaroons, and so forth. But now they're clearly going after the baby boom generation, because now we're being given cappuccino chip macaroons. We're being given banana split macaroons, which is not something I even want to think about. And then, amazingly enough, cookies and cream macaroons. This is a cookies and cream cookie we're talking about. You know, what's up with that? I don't know. I think you're best off leaving the store-bought macaroons in the store and just making them for yourself, because, you know, the little secret about macaroons is that they're unbelievably easy to make.
So what do you do?
Well, the first thing you do is you take blanched almonds, which you can get anywhere, and you grind them up in a food processor. You know, it takes about 15 seconds. You mix them with sugar and sweetened shredded coconut, which you find in the baking department of the supermarket.
Right.
You beat up some egg whites, and you fold it into the almond mixture, and then you proceed to drop the mixture by heaping tablespoons onto a parchment-lined baking sheet. And that's it. If you want to get really fancy, you can put the mixture into a pastry bag with a big tip and you get that little rosette shape. But that seems a little fussy to me. Basically, that's it. It's about 10 minutes of work. You put it into a 350-degree oven, bake them until they're golden brown, 15 or 20 minutes, and that's it. They're done. They're warm, they're moist, they're chewy, they're sweet. You're a hero to your friends and family. Nobody will believe you've made macaroons, and it only took you about half an hour. And, you know, the other thing, Lynn, that I want to point out is that, like turkey for Thanksgiving, you don't have to save macaroons just for Passover. They're great any time, right? I mean, think about it. Macaroons all year round. I can't think of a better way to live. Can you?
Well, and also you don't have to be Jewish, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I can do this too.
Macaroons are absolutely ecumenical.
Well, Matthew, thank you, and Guten Pesach.
Oh, and to you as well. Thank you, Lynn.
Take care. Matthew Goodman writes for the national Jewish publication, The Forward. You can get Matthew's recipe for macaroons two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101, or go to our website at splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open. Give us a call. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's talk. Anything goes. We're going to go right to the phones. We have Sue on the line. Sue, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my phone call. Well, I have a problem. In fact, to be very honest, it's a problem I share with 75 students in my class.
What is this problem?
Well, we've just finished studying about ancient Rome and
uh-huh.
the ancient Roman Empire, and we'd like to recreate a Roman forum and perhaps have a little feast along the way. My problem is that we've researched a Roman feast. In fact, we even looked up the philosopher Epicurus.
Yeah.
And what we found was a really horrendous menu. It starts with hummingbird wings, peacock beaks, and stuffed dormouse with honey and poppy seeds.
Oh.
So I called up my local store. They've got the honey and the poppy seeds. It's the first three ingredients they don't have.
But you know, there.
No, wait, that's not the end of my problem.
All right.
The end of the problem is I don't have access to a stove, and we would like to eat with our fingers the way the ancient Romans did.
Right.
So I don't think they trusted their friends with knives, especially after Julius Caesar. So I would like to serve something cool or cold, something if I have to, I'll make it home gladly. But I would love the children to make it.
Oh, boy. So what you're asking me is, what would the ancient Romans have eaten?
Yeah.
That what class? What grade is it?
It's a sixth grade class.
How old are people in sixth grade? Because I have no memory at this point.
They're still 11 and 12.
Okay. So that'd be something that the kids really want to eat.
Well, yeah. You see, you can't have pasta. It hasn't been invented.
That's right.
Tomatoes
That's right.
are from the New World.
Right. All that stuff is from the, you know, honey, not honey, vanilla and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's
yeah.
from the New World. Okay. First of all, one thing comes to mind. There
okay.
is a book. Now, the writers, I don't remember the name of the book. I want to say it's something like Dinner with Lucullus. Lucullus, something like L-L-U-S, and excuse my mispronunciation. But the writer's name is Giacosa, G-I-A-C-O-S-A. The author's name is Giacosa.
Right.
I'd say take a look at the book, but a couple of things come to mind. There was a lot of sweet and savory stuff that the Romans liked. So did everybody else for,
right.
you know, a couple of thousand years afterward. But a couple of things you might do that would not violate authenticity that the kids could enjoy would be things like dried or fresh figs arranged with slices of salami.
Oh, I love that.
And fresh fennel.
Oh, nice.
And they could pound in more, if you could get the mortar and pestles, because that would be the way the Romans would have done this, they could take fennel seed and celery seed and black pepper and pound that together with a little salt, and you sprinkle that on the fresh sliced fennel.
Oh, nice.
And that's a combination of taste. Also, cumin was used. So, you know, that's the kind of thing, and they could have some bread with that, probably a bread that's a mixture of whole wheat and white flours.
All right.
Okay? but take a look at that book by Giacosa.
I will.
I think the kids will be fascinated, and so will you.
All right. I thank you for your help.
Yeah, it's a book. Every once in a while, I take it to bed because it's so interesting.
Oh, good.
Hey, Sue, thanks for calling.
Thank you for your help.
And best to the kids.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question. Since it's the season that a lot of us think about eggs, it's an egg question. Our trivia question this week is, how do you size eggs? If it's not written on the egg carton, how do you tell the egg size? Like, how do you tell if it's large or extra large or jumbo? We'll be back in a moment with that answer and stalking wild mushrooms in Santa Cruz with the Wild Mushroom Man and more of your calls. So get to those phones. The number's 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about the world of the table. We're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. But before going there, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. In honor of this being egg season, the question was, how do you tell the size of an egg? If it weren't written on the egg carton, how would you tell if an egg is large or extra large or jumbo? The answer is, weigh it. Farmers have always weighed eggs to size them. In fact, you can find old egg scales in antique shops. Here's the code to egg size. A large egg weighs 2 ounces, an extra large egg weighs 2.25 ounces, and a jumbo egg weighs 2.5 ounces. In the real world, the only time it's important to know the size of your egg is in baking. That's where the wrong size can create problems. Usually when a baking recipe calls for an egg, it's calling for a large egg. Now, did you know you can test an egg's freshness at home? Just put the egg in a bowl of water. If it sinks, it's fresh. If it floats, it isn't. And if it just tips up but doesn't float, it's your average supermarket egg and it is safe to eat. While we're on the subject, always store eggs in the refrigerator in a closed container. Their shells are porous. They can lose moisture and absorb odors. So that's your egg guide for this week. Let's get back to those phones. Again, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Peter on the phone. Peter, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm fine.
Lynn, I am someone who enjoys greens a great deal. And one of the greens I've not had that I'd like to try is fiddlehead ferns. And I know relatively little about them and thought maybe you could assist me on telling me how to get them or where to buy them. Unsuccessful in finding that on the internet, but maybe you can help me.
You know, when ferns first start to come out of the ground, they're all curled up. Their fronds are tightly curled, and it looks like the top of a violin or a fiddle. And that's the fiddlehead fern. And if you just trim those off, you're not going to get any ferns. But they're something that comes up around this time of year, March, April, and they're considered a great delicacy. Now, here's my problem with fiddlehead ferns. Fancy food stores carry them. For instance, I would bet that if you called Balducci's or Dean and DeLuca in New York City, they could ship you fiddleheads. Brace yourself. You're not going to be able to pay the mortgage this month for what it's going to cost, but they could probably do it.
I'll be in Manhattan in a few weeks, and I'll try them.
I'll try them and call ahead to make sure, you know, that they've got them. But here's my problem with them, that unless they're absolutely pristinely fresh, they tend to get, I'm going to use the blunt word because this is what happens, they get slimy. And they don't taste very good. And they really have to be in prime condition. And the way they're usually cooked, some people parboil them. They just drop them in boiling water for a second or two and then drain them. But what a lot of people do is saute them in butter or other flavorful fat, like a little olive oil, and maybe they would add some shallot to it, some gentle herbs, like maybe chopped chives. Simple things, because you want to taste the flavor of the fiddlehead. But if they're not pristinely fresh, forget it. It's just not worth the money, and you'll just be disappointed. But if you've got woods near you, you could go out and get your own.
And they are not a specific species. I don't have to afraid of eating something that
I don't want to send you. I don't want to send you to the beyond, Peter. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's a specific type of fern that turns, you know, that's the edible fiddlehead. Oh boy, you know where you'd find information on this? God, there's this naturalist we had on a long time ago, like 2 or 3 years ago. He's based in New York City. I want to say Steve, I think it's Steve Brill, B-R-I-L-L, and he's a forager. And he's done a book, and he may have something up on the internet. Steve Brill, B-R-I-L-L, yeah, that's it, okay. And he's a forager, and he did a great book on foraging, and by the way, foraging in the city of all places.
Really?
But I'll bet you he has information so that we won't kill you with the fiddlehead foraging.
Lynn, may I ask you one other question?
Sure.
I had found a recipe called pie, ba- Pie Bim Bap. Are you familiar with that?
Pie Bim Bap. No, but it sounds like Curtis, a song.
Curtis Akins is the person who supplied the recipe, but he used two ingredients that I'm not familiar with. One was K-I-N-G-U-I.
Wait a minute. I'm going to write this down because I'm very bad at visualizing. K-I-N-G-U-I. Yeah, okay.
Ooey or something.
Yeah.
And K-O-C-H-U-G-A-N-G.
G-A-N-G. I think, and what kind of recipe is it?
This, I'm going to say it's obviously Oriental because
yeah.
It's over white rice, and then you add a spinach salad and a fiddlehead salad to the rice with soy sauce, sesame oil, but then you sprinkle on king ghee and gochujang.
I wonder if they're not forms of dried seaweed that you might crush.
Interesting.
I'm not sure. I'll tell you two places again. You can look it up, though. There's a fabulous book by Charlene Solomon called Asian Ingredients. It's an encyclopedia. And there is a book by Bruce Cost called Asian, I think it's called Asian Ingredients. So Charlene Solomon, the Encyclopedia of Asian Ingredients or Asian Foods, and it's a big book. It's, you know, 8.5 by 11 or more. And then a smaller book that came out in the 1970s, but it's still around, and that's by Bruce Cost, C-O-S-T.
Okay.
Yeah, but I wonder if these aren't forms of dried seaweed that you would crumble over the top of things.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very possibly. Hey, thank you. You know, great puzzles, Peter. I love this. Sorry to send you to more of the books, but I'm going to do some checking, too.
Thank you, Lynn.
Hey, thank you. John's on the line. So, John, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a fairly common problem. My wife and I are fairly intense wine geeks, and we have a lot of friends, and we invite them over, but in small groups. We don't like any group more than 6 or 7 people for semi-serious wine tastings, and we have trouble thinking up and providing appropriate, I guess they'd be called hors d'oeuvres or finger foods or something other than a sit-down dinner that would complement an array of wine. I've heard that hors d'oeuvres are the hardest thing to make for a dinner. I don't know, but I need advice on fairly easy to prepare hors d'oeuvres that will complement rich wine.
Gosh, I love cheese. I mean, there's an old saying about when you're buying wine, always taste it with bread, and when you're selling wine, always make sure that who you're selling it to tastes it with cheese, because the protein in the cheese activates your palate in a way that everything tastes good.
Okay.
But if you've already done that, then I think the other thing I would think about, does this have to be finger food?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay. You know what I would think about? How about some open tarts?
Really?
Yeah, savory tarts. How about doing a tart where you mix wild mushrooms? Take a skillet, film it with a little bit of olive oil, big skillet though, coarsely chop every kind of wild mushroom you can find in your market. If it's just portobellos, which aren't wild, that's fine. But you want big chunks of mushroom that you've rinsed and washed and then patted very dry.
Okay.
And toss that with coarse chopped onion and get it really seared, you know, as hot as the devil. And then throw in a handful of basil leaves and some garlic. And cook it another few seconds, and then add some white wine and boil it down to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, spread that in a pizza pan that you have lined with a pie crust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a nice flaky pie crust. And have your oven at about 500 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Stick it in the oven. Take about 10 minutes maybe, you know, until things are starting to get crusty. And then sprinkle it lightly with some shredded cheese. You might use an Asiago. I'm thinking of cheeses that you might use a Gruyere. I'm thinking about cheeses that are nutty.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and serve that in pieces, and then and then do something similar when tomatoes are in season. Or have you got these grape tomatoes? You know,
yes, we do, and we've got small grape tomatoes that are sold in our local deli on the vine.
Those are so good. Have those babies.
Mm-hmm.
Toss them with olive oil and fresh herbs. And garlic. Take, again, that big pie crust.
in a pizza pan, because you want it to be real shallow. You don't want to pile things on. You want them spread out. And I would say spread that in there, put it in that blazing hot oven, and give it just a few thin slices of mozzarella. Savory tarts. You know, this is
wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. And I do tarragon with the tomatoes. Do the unexpected. You know, something like tarragon and thyme with the tomatoes.
Okay.
So give it a Provençal feeling. Both of these are going to look good, and they're going to be really interesting with the wines.
Well, that's delightful.
Okay, give that a shot. But also, as I said, I'm a cheese nut. I just, you know, a great Beaufort with a lusty, delicious, complex red. I'm yours.
That's wonderful.
I'm yours.
Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, and enjoy the tastings.
We shall.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Goodbye, bye-bye. John. This is the time of year when people who forage for mushrooms are happier than pigs in mud. We're going foraging in the hills of Santa Cruz with reporter Rachel Goodman and the Wild Mushroom Man.
Meet Lee Yamada, president of the Santa Cruz Fungus Federation and self-described Wild Mushroom Man. On the day of our trek, he's dressed in full camouflage gear. Instead of green and khaki, though, Lee's baggy pants are covered with pictures of orange and brown mushrooms.
See, I've got my chanterelles here, and I've got my Bolitis edulis here, just in case I need to check which mushrooms that I found.
You just look on your pants.
Exactly.
As a child, Lee learned to stalk the mysterious mushroom and other wild foods with his mother.
We used to forage for, you know, go down to the ocean and forage for, you know, seaweed, abalone, clams, mussels. So, you know, that portion of me, the hunter-gatherer, kind of remained.
On today's foray, Lee brings along a wicker basket containing waxed paper bags and a knife. From Lee's back garden, we plunge downhill into the underbrush.
Let's see. We'll go down this way and take one of these deer trails.
Dead man's foot, witch's butter, stink horn. Creative names designed to warn us away from eating them.
Aha, I see something.
Whoa, I see some too. Gold.
Yes, they are gold in the Bar Hills.
The gold we found is Cantharellus sabarius, the prized chanterelle. It sells for $14 a pound in local stores, and restaurants get top dollar for dishes prepared with this pumpkin orange fungus.
There's another one over there. Wow, oh, this is going to be great.
Wow. Oh, I see one hiding under here, too.
Oh, wow, I didn't even see that one.
Oh, boy.
Oh, we're going to have something to eat today.
Lunch.
Oh, look at it. There's another one over there, too.
Maybe it goes back to our hunter-gatherer beginnings, but there's something thrilling about finding your supper for free. Lee brushes each mushroom with a stiff paintbrush.
And see how I clean them up and get all the... as much of the dirt as I can off of it.
By the time we're done scrambling around on our knees, our basket is overflowing with bright orange chanterelles, brown honeys, plus one prized Bolitis edulis to take home and cook.
It's like fishing or any other sport, just getting out and getting to do what you like to do is very fun, but when you get what you're looking for, it makes it just doubly better.
And like any fisherman who's found a special pool, Lee keeps his mushroom spots a secret. In fact, in taking me here, he's breaking the number one code of the mushroom hunter.
You know, people ask me, where do I hunt for my mushroom? I don't hunt in Santa Cruz County. There's no mushrooms in Santa Cruz County. It's all in Monterey County, San Mateo.
Wait a minute. This sounds like you're trying to keep a high-tech secret here.
I know of one man who changed his license plate because every time he would go out mushroom hunting, someone would see his car and say, oh, there he is. He must be hunting mushrooms there. They'd pull him behind him. We need to go to the left here a little bit, kind of
exactly.
Wander on up.
Now it's back up the steep hill and on to one of the great rituals of mushroom hunting, the feast.
The small pieces? Or
yeah, small.
In Lee's kitchen, we wash and chop the fungus among us.
So we'll put this Zeller's bolete in here and start sauteing them up a little bit. Put a little bit of salt.
Lee's pantry is full, top to bottom, with jars of dried mushrooms he's found. Morels, porcini, chanterelles, candy caps, each with its unique flavor.
Now this one is the honey mushroom.
That's a pretty earthy tasting mushroom.
Mm-hmm. So this is the famed porcini.
Mmm, isn't that good? Mm-hmm. A couple of bites of fruity, chewy chanterelle and our tasting is complete. It's taken Lee years to learn how to find and prepare his favorite fungi, and some lessons came the hard way. While he learned to steer clear of the death cap and some other deadly varieties, he did once poison himself by not properly cooking a sulfur shelf mushroom.
But then there's an old axiom that says there are old mushroom eaters and there are bold mushroom eaters, but there are not old bold mushroom eaters.
That piece was produced for us by Rachel Goodman. Get yourself a good mushroom guide and get out in the woods this week, guys. Hey, everybody, thanks for joining us today. Have a great week. We'll be back next week, and in the meantime, let me leave you with a thought from MFK Fisher. Probably one of the most private things in the world is an egg until it's broken. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101, or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, be sure to swing by the Splendid Table store. It's an ever-changing collection of things I love to have in my kitchen. And in true public radio style, all the proceeds go to support this program. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.